Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Welcome to this year's Government and Opposition Leonard Shapiro Lecture. The lecture is sponsored by the journal Government and Opposition and, of course, commemorates one of the founding editors of the journal. We invite each year a distinguished scholar to reflect on a subject of their choice, and it's especially apposite that this year's lecturer is one of our most distinguished scholars of communism and the transition to communism, Professor Stephen White from the University of Glasgow. These are the bare facts. Stephen White is Professor of International Politics at the University of Glasgow, a former president of the British Association for Slavonic and East European Studies, and a fellow of the Royal Society of Edinburgh. His recent books include Russia's New Politics and jointly The Political Elite from Lenin to Gorbachev. That's the bare recitation. But Stephen is legendary for his creativity and his prodigious industry. And tonight he's going to talk about rethinking post-communist transition.
Stephen. Well, thank you very much. And let me begin by thanking the people who've made the lecture possible, who were kind enough to invite me, Rosalind Jones. I should thank, first of all, for the practical aspects of these arrangements. And let me thank the journal as well. I have a soft spot for the journal. The journal was the place where my first serious article was published, the first after contributions to the school magazine, so to speak, way back in 1971, a contribution on Gramsci and the Italian Communist Party. I was paid, this was, I think, and still is relatively unusual, paid about £30, which was welcome at the time. I'm glad to say the article has recently been reprinted, and the journal and I were actually able to share a cheque for £100, but I think, nonetheless, I can't, given inflation, promise that the journal has, so to speak, gained on the transaction over the years. But it's a journal that gave me a start in the academic literature. Of course, it's a great honor to lecture in the name of Leonard Shapiro. We met several times. We corresponded. He'd taken a close interest in the material that was brought back by the British Labour delegation that went to Russia in 1920, who brought back a lot of things that they put in the library. I'm very glad to see that his library is preserved here as an integral collection, including all the little scribblings and marginal annotations that he felt able to indulge in on his own books, admittedly. Also, of course, the scholarship that was established in his name, to which at the time I made a contribution. What I think probably many of you won't know is that although, of course, his career took place in London and at the school in particular, Leonard was born in Glasgow. I often wonder how he would have reacted to many of the developments that have happened since he was academically active, how he would have reacted, for example, not just to the establishment of post-communist rule and the end of the USSR. I'm sure he would have been delighted, but he wasn't simply an opponent of communism, so to speak, and of the causes of communism, as people have sometimes put it. He was, of course, also someone who was very passionately committed to the rule of law, who was a practicing barrister, and I've always wondered how he would have reacted to some of the developments which, in a way, have perplexed us since that time, how he would have reacted, for example, when the people who called themselves Democrats, whom instinctively he would have supported, began to line their own pockets, which I think is a matter of public record, and also when they began to violate the Constitution. And this was, I think, particularly true in September, October 1993, in admittedly an enormously difficult situation. But there is, I think, no doubt that at the time the regime stepped outside the Constitution, that more than 100 people died as a result of what some have called a short civil war. And I very much wonder, Western governments, of course, supported the Russian administration of the day. I wonder on whose side Leonard Shapiro would have been, whether he would have supported the people who called themselves Democrats because they called themselves Democrats, or whether the rule of law and the Constitution and respect for those sorts of values would have come higher. And of course, I hope it would have done. There won't, I'm afraid, be any chance to pursue those matters with him until we both reach the great seminar room in the sky, and I hope, of course, that's not too soon. Now, Leonard saw himself as an historian, and some of you may have seen, perhaps, can I say, older people here will have seen, perhaps, the Open University film, which was made quite some time ago about, for a course on comparative politics, and it featured a number of wise, senior figures in the discipline. One was Len Shapiro, one was Sammy Feiner. At a certain point in the proceedings, a young lady asked Leonard Shapiro, did he think there could be a science of comparative politics? And Leonard looked extremely distressed by even the question and basically said no. Well, of course, I'm going to go beyond that, wisely or otherwise. I'm going to try to ask not just what has happened since 1989-91, but begin to question how we might make sense of it. And of course, it's still too soon to say, as Joan Lai said about the French Revolution, but I think it's not too soon to have some reservations and some second thoughts about the process that at the time we're very happy to call the transition to democracy. And a very, very widely used term. I searched the library catalogues. There are more than 1,200 books currently with the title of Transition to Democracy, and more than 500,000 references in Google, not all of which I've got to, I have to say. And I want here really to take issue, I think, really with all of those at the time optimistic and hopeful assumptions, though it is a nice sunny day. I want to take issue with the idea of transition. I think it's unhelpful with its teleological assumptions that there's a necessary movement in a certain direction, a little bit like the old Soviet notion that societies had to evolve from primitive to slave to feudal to capitalist to socialist, and not sideways or backwards or anything like that. Certainly, I think not a transition, which is particularly unfortunate, not necessarily to democracy, which I think wouldn't helpful without very heavy qualifications. To be honest, I'm not sure about two in this little the little set of words. It does have rather determinist associations, but perhaps I should leave it for the moment. And it's clear, I think, given the time, perhaps even given the nature of the occasion, I'm not going to be able to offer a complete alternative. But nonetheless, I hope in the time available to contribute to some of the, as it were, second thoughts about what has taken place in the rest of the continent that we share over the past 10 to 15 years. I'd like to begin this, if I may, with something that's more or less autobiographical. It's to look at some of the ways in which we've thought about, reflected upon changes or major changes, even breaks in history in the recent past and in the more remote past. And it was a subject that came to my attention very quickly when I began my own degree in history in Dublin back in the early 1960s. Very soon clear that many of the divisions that we always assumed were in some way given were by no means given, were very arbitrary and problematic. Very worthwhile book, I think, still by Oskar Hlecky on the limits of divisions of European history, which addressed many of these questions in a general way. Indeed, it began to appear as if even the division on which, of course, the degree in history in most universities at the time was basically founded, the division between ancient and modern and medieval, was really rather doubtful indeed. Modern went up to 1914, at which it stopped, so that was, so to speak, the end of history, as it were, as taught, in the, taught at the time. Ancient was thought to become medieval in exactly 476 AD. This was when Rome, the Western Empire, was taken and collapsed, beginning of the Dark Ages, as people used to describe it. Many of the values that were implicit in the notion of Rome civilization being sacked by barbarians have, of course, lodged themselves firmly in our culture, not only in our academic culture, but terms like Hun and Vandal and so to speak, occur in all kinds of ways. It occurs to me they must surface even in football matches between Britain and Germany and this sort of thing, even to our own time. But extremely problematic, and from relatively early on, scholars were suggesting that this was an unhelpful kind of division. One of the first was a French medievalist, Ferdinand Lo, one of the first to expose this distinction. As he pointed out, the barbarians were relatively few. They were uncoordinated. They had no particular hatred of the empire. They just wanted its land, and they were very keen to settle down. And there was a rather more ambitious treatment by a German scholar, a book I think that's still read, by Dopsch, Economic and Social Foundations of European Civilization, published in the 1930s. Dopsch looked at the archaeological evidence. He looked at coins and where they'd ended up. He looked at place names and philological evidence and things of that sort. And he found that there had been no rupture, no abrupt break from Romanism to Germanism, so to speak. Rather, there had been a steady evolution. He pointed out the word, of course, barbarians at the time didn't have the unfortunate associations that it has now. The barbarians, so-called, had settled in Roman lands as tenants. They'd moved into the town. They served happily in the army, in the civil service. They'd intermarried with the locals. Dobbs refers at this point to peaceful penetration of Germans into the empire, and I always wondered what he had in mind by that. So Roman civilization, in other words, hadn't been destroyed. It had been rather preserved or even developed. And throughout all of this, if there was a single principle that was important to seize hold of, it was the notion that there was, as Dobbs put it, the fundamental law of the evolution of humanity. Many, many similar historiographical exercises were carried out in connection with the Viking invasions, for example, where the sources were generally biased in the sense that they came overwhelmingly from people writing written records in monasteries, which were, of course, where the sensible Vikings went first to liberate some of the wealth of the time, or about the French Revolution, writers in the tradition of de Tocqueville, who wrote about the laws and political practices of the old regime, as he put it, disappearing in 1789, only to reappear a few years later, like some rivers that go underground, only to reappear a few miles further on, the same stream between different banks. Now, the end of communist rule in Central and Eastern Europe, it seems to me, raises some of these issues in a rather similar way. And the questions that I'll be addressing are how radical a break, how different the new society. And I think there's a helpful way into this discussion through a recent article by the Russian sociologist, some of you will know probably, Tatiana Zaslavskaya. This is an article in the main sociological journal published a few months ago, towards the end of last year. This is a scholar who, of course, has a position, a scholar who helped to lay down the intellectual origins of perestroika. Now the doyen of the profession, she's someone who's gone beyond her 75th birthday and hasn't, I think, had perfect health throughout all of that, but nonetheless, someone who's lost none of her radical bite, which is welcome to see. And she suggests, really, that three views can be taken when we try to make sense of the pattern of change that is taking place across particularly Russia and the post-communist world over these past 10 to 15 years. And the three views are, of course, first of all, that there was a great revolution, a revolution of the classic fully-fledged kind. A second view is that what happened was in some way a counter-revolution, that a group that had seized power with the aim of usurping or dissolving the gains of the revolution in the 1920s, a group around Stalin, had finally succeeded, and this is, I suppose, broadly a Trotskyist view, though Zaslavskaya doesn't identify it as that. And then there's a third view, and this is really her own view, and I'll come back to this in a minute. The third view is that there was the potential for a radical democratic revolution, something less than a fully-fledged social revolution, at the end of the 1980s, an anti-nomenklatura revolution, an egalitarian and democratic radical revolution, but one that for various reasons didn't materialize. Rather, she says, it was taken over by the nomenklatura, by officialdom, and used by them as a vehicle to conduct their own reforms from above in their own interests. It is, as it were, hijacked and misused. Now, as Zaslavskaya notes, different views about the past are, of course, as everywhere, connected with different views about the present. Those who are most in favor of the changes that have taken place since 1991, those who are most committed to them, are, of course, those who are most keen to claim, most keen to argue that the changes have been fundamental and desirable, of course, and far-reaching. Boris Yeltsin was one of these in his memoirs, for example. At the time, just after the defeat of the August coup in 1991, the attempted coup, he claimed that the Russian people had, quote, thrown off the chains of 70 years of slavery, and he said they had were on their way to establishing parliamentary democracy. He didn't help it a lot himself subsequently, one has to say. He even described the defeat of the coup, he said, as the end not just of communist rule, which was arguable enough, but of the 20th century itself, when he said in three short days, one century had ended and another had begun. And you might well think he has in mind Hobsbawm's book about the short 20th century and so on. I think it's a purely fortuitous parallel there. The two books are published, in fact, in the same year. Or if we take Yeltsin's prime minister for some period of time, and of course an academic, still active and prominent, Yegor Gaidar, in his memoirs, equally, he suggests the end of communist rule was a revolution fully comparable with the great revolutions, the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, the Chinese Revolution, a revolution involving changes in the socioeconomic system and in the dominant ideology, although he argues that the revolution wasn't really established until 1993, the new order wasn't established until 1993 and not consolidated until 1996, until Yeltsin's second victory in the presidential elections. Of course, those who are less enthusiastic about the changes and less committed to them have been less willing to concede these far-reaching claims and have been less willing to applaud the results. Zaslavska points out, for example, that they're by no means agreed among themselves, the people who argue that these were revolutionary changes. They're not, for example, even now rather clear about what social forces had carried out this revolution, if it was a revolution. There's even an amusing bit in Gaidar's memoirs where Yeltsin starts to get anxious about this and asks them, oh, by the way, you know, what are the social forces that we're leading here? And of course, nobody can could really tell him. Nor is there much agreement about the moment when the revolution is supposed to occur. Was it the collapse of the August coup in 1991? Or was it the crushing of his parliamentary opponents by Yeltsin in September-October 1993? Other people say, well, yes, there was a revolution, but it was only in the major cities. It wasn't throughout the vast expanse of Russian territory. For Zaslavskaya, there are several serious objections to the notion of this as a revolution, at least in this far-reaching sense. One of them is the notion that there had been a far-reaching change in the composition of the ruling group, that there had been a new elite, a new ruling group that had displaced the previously, that had displaced the incumbents. Very much not, in her view, and very much unlike the changes that took place in Central and Eastern Europe. Rather, as we know, something like three-quarters of the leadership of the Yeltsin period was derived from people with a nomenklatura background. Over 80% at regional level were people who had this kind of a background in officialdom. They went overthrowing the established officialdom. Yeltsin himself, of course, had been a party member for 30 years. He'd been a member of the party leadership, of the Politburo, and of the Secretariat. His prime minister for very many years, this is Viktor Chernomyrdin, still prominent, currently ambassador to Ukraine, one of the world's richest men, which is quite surprising. Given the salary he was employed on when he was gas minister, he was, of course, also a member of the Central Committee. And many, many more examples, individual examples, could be given. Very different, taken together from the position in Poland or the Czech Republic or Hungary, where the post-communist presidents were, as a rule, and not exceptionally, people who had been political prisoners, at least at some point during the previous regime. In Russia, again, and this is Zaslavskaya points out, no mass movement, no sort of people power, no surge of energy from the streets, so to speak, that had overwhelmed an existing ruling group. The regime itself had been the driving force of change. Political energies of ordinary people hardly involved at any point. Very little violence compared even with the revolutions and changes in East Central Europe. And Zaslavskaya said, very hard to conceive of a social revolution if, as she puts it, it's hardly apparently been noticed by the society in which it took place. I think perhaps that's going a little bit far on the basis of the evidence we have, but the survey evidence does certainly suggest, a little bit perhaps counterintuitively for some of you, there was and there is overwhelming regret, not delight, that the USSR ceased to exist. The defeat of the August coup is very widely seen, not at all as the victory of democratic forces in some sort of way, but as another intra-elite maneuver. And the October Revolution, people are asked periodically in surveys, you know, which side would you be on if it was to happen again? And still to the present, there was only earlier this year was the last of these surveys, I believe, more people say they would support the Bolsheviks, many more than say they would support their opponents, although still larger numbers sensibly say they'd take no part whatsoever. And a sensible number of people say actually they would emigrate if this happened again. So accordingly for Zaslavskaya, no revolution, but after so many years could hardly be seen as a counter-revolution, very delayed one. Better perhaps to go back to the notion that I gave you a minute ago, to see this as a movement directed against nomenclatura power, against a system that had become authoritarian and bureaucratic. Its driving force, people like, I suppose, her, the well-qualified but marginalized intelligentsia, people in universities and institutes and places of that sort, whose aim wasn't the replacement of Soviet socialism, but its perfection, and the language we used to use at the time, widening civil liberties and improving the living standards of ordinary people. But this movement, as she said, had been blocked and taken over, didn't survive the collapse of the USSR itself, and the initiative passed to a group around Yeltsin, a clique really around Yeltsin, who had presided over, and these are her terms, the plundering of public assets, wholesale criminalization, and the collapse of state authority. Western scholars, too, are divided in their views about whether it's useful to speak of a revolution as having taken place in these circumstances or not. Certainly, Tilley, in one of the leading studies of revolution, warns against simple analogies between the classic revolutions, the great revolutions, and what has taken place in Eastern Europe in 1989-91. A scholar based in the International Relations Department here, who has also written, of course, about revolution, similarly says it's not helpful to think of a revolution that in some way displaced a revolution or a revolutionary regime, which was carried out in the name of old-fashioned ideas, not thrusting new and different ideas. And of course, there's been no agreement whatsoever about, not just about whether revolution is a useful term in this context, equally about what kind of society had been has been established subsequent to revolution. Nominally, of course, we've seen the wholesale transfer of property from one group to another, from state to private ownership, but it's very puzzling. There isn't really a capitalist class out there. The structure of ownership remains extremely opaque. State and private ownership are often extremely difficult to distinguish. The state is actually, even on official figures, a dominant element within the economy. It accounts for more than half, or the private at any rate accounts for less than half of employment, less than half of capital employed, less than half of industrial output. Izvestia, in a piece just a week ago that I read coming down in the train, in fact, has said that the idea that there had been more than this, that property really had been overwhelmingly transferred into private hands, was, they put it, just a myth manufactured for the benefit of Russian Western students of Russia. Thanks very much. We've got enough myths of our own, I think, as things stand. They suggested, Izvestia, that really the reality was very much the other way around, remaining overwhelmingly state. If it is capitalism, a lot of people have tried to find a suitable label for that unusual kind of capitalism. Is it crony capitalism, nomenclatura capitalism, not just ordinary capitalism, certainly? Perhaps even, some have argued, a mutant of an entirely new kind, something neither capitalist nor socialist. Similarly, arguments whether or not people think there's been a revolution, about whether some form of democracy, whether that's a useful term, about the political regime that's been established subsequently. All kinds of other suggestions have been offered. Competitive authoritarianism is used. Neoliberal autocracy is used. The East European Constitutional Review, a very mainstream journal, speaks of emergency-based authoritarian rule behind a quasi-democratic facade. And I think the most extravagant definition, but one that does, I think, tell us something, third world patrimonialism with Bonapartist tendencies, which is a new one, I think, for most of us. So there's no agreement then, it seems to me, to put it mildly, on the nature of the changes that we've seen or on the kind of society that has replaced straightforward communist rule. I'd like to move a little further forward now to look perhaps more positively at some of the ways in which there has been change and change of various kinds. And to do this, I want to look not just as at systems in some sort of unitary sense. I want to try to take account of different levels of change, change in the political system or the social system or the economy, and to look across a wider range of cases than simply the Russian. Certainly, I want to look more widely at some of the other Soviet republics. And I want to do this looking at two kinds of evidence. First of all, the views judgments of outsiders, if you like, people connected particularly with Freedom House, which is a view from outside of the nature of these regimes and of the change over time. Equally, I'd like to look at the other side, what the citizens within these regimes think about them and what judgments they reach themselves, and that will, of course, involve using survey evidence. And so with these two bodies of evidence, now I want to begin to try to develop a more positive view of the nature of these changes. So first of all, then, the classification that's offered by Freedom House. Many of you will know of Freedom House, based in New York. Its work is very frequently criticized, and indeed I published an article myself attempting to rubbish it, but it's very widely used. It's convenient and cheap. It's been in existence now for 30 years. And Freedom House uses really a twofold set of concepts. It uses, first of all, an evaluation of political rights. Political rights are the relatively straightforward rights, the right to take part in the political process, the right to take part in elections, the right to take part in the choosing of leaders and the shaping of public decisions. Those are political rights. But equally, Freedom House looks at civil rights, at the freedom, as they put it, to develop views, institutions, and personal autonomy apart from the state. In other words, the freedom of trade unions to organize themselves freely, of courts to be outside the control of government, of the media to be outside the control of government, and matters of that kind. Each of these dimensions are rated between 1 and 7, 1 being the top and 7 being the bottom. They're then combined, and of course many of you will know this, into a admittedly rather rough and ready classification. This classification is either free, that's so to speak the best, or partly free, which is obviously not so good, and then not free, this threefold classification. And for this they use a variety of sources. They obviously look at academic work, they take their advice from NGOs as well, from academic analyses, from the press, sometimes from field visits. And I've tried to set out some evidence here derived from Freedom House for 2 points in time, for 2 points in Soviet time, thank you very much, and also for 2 points in post-Soviet, post-communist time. And you'll see these here. And I want to ask then what, first of all, looking from outside, so to speak, using Freedom House evidence, what does this pattern tell us? And I want to make a number of suggestions about the kinds of lessons that we can draw from this pattern. I think the first thing, conclusion that we can draw from this kind of pattern is, so to speak, that there isn't a pattern. There is variety. There are a whole series of patterns. There's not simply one dimension going sort of from bottom left to top right, so to speak, as you see it here, in terms of a movement towards a more democratic state. Rather, it appears, there are four rather distinct groups which need to be picked out and looked at separately. First of all, and this would be the little block at the top right, the Baltic republics, the free, and according to Freedom House, these are typically Christian, that's to say Lutheran or Roman Catholic. They typically have had a shorter period of communist rule, generally since the Second World War. Generally, they have had higher living standards, higher levels of GDP per head than the other Soviet republics. And typically, and I think this is more important than many of us thought to begin with, their location is on the western perimeter of the former USSR. It's a little bit like the auction houses, the estate agents who say location, 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 and so on. A rather good argument, it seems to me, has been made out of a general kind for the importance of location in an article some of you may know by Michael McFaul in World Politics in January last year, which in a general way seeks to establish the importance, the causal significance of simply location. So that's a first group. A second group, the partly free, they're typically Orthodox, or at any rate, they're not Western Christian. They've typically been under communist rule since 1917 or something of the sort. They're typically low or middle income. They are aware by, for example, World Bank standards. They're generally, location again, they're generally Eurasian or West Eurasian, Central Eurasian, rather than Central European. Nobody any longer apparently is East European, seems to have disappeared. So that is a second group. A third group, and I think this is our bottom group here, are the unfree or the not free. I think we have to describe them. These are typically Muslim, and this is an empirical matter so far as I'm concerned, not an unpleasant assertion. They're low income. They are Asian. Generally speaking, it seems to me that Azerbaijan, on the scores that you have here, it comes in, I think, at 6-6 or something like that, 6-5, should actually be in the bottom group. It seems to me wholly arbitrarily it's been defined as partly free. It should really be in the bottom group, it seems to me, here. And, of course, if it were, then my more or less Huntingtonian categories, cultural categories, would work even better. Some of these regimes in this picture are not just not free. They have, as you will know, developed bizarre forms of personless rule. Two of them, Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan, have been picked out, in fact, by Freedom House for their list of, quotes, the world's most repressive regimes, 2003. I don't think that's on their letterhead of their embassies in foreign countries necessarily, but it's not a reasonable, not an unreasonable judgment. They join an undistinguished list, including North Korea, Equatorial Guinea, and Iraq before this war began. These countries, of course, are hardly rejoining Europe or anything of the sort. They're some of the rejoining the Middle Ages, it would look like. And then there's a fourth group, and this is a fourth group that obviously you can't see here. These are the non-transitioners, but don't forget about them, intellectually at least. They include China, North Korea, Vietnam, Cuba, I think, has special characteristics. So, of course, it's in this group. They're also Asian. They're also not Christian. They're also low income, though it's changing a little bit. And, of course, they're very populous. And I mean here, of course, not just China that you'll be familiar with, but on some projections, also Vietnam. On reasonable projections, up to the year 2050, Vietnam will likely have a larger population than Russia, which is Russia contracting and Vietnam expanding. Four groups, it seems to me, first of all, no pattern. I think a second conclusion that can reasonably be drawn is there's no trajectory either. There's no steady movement, albeit at different speeds and from different starting points. No movement in something like the democratic equivalent of the old Soviet graph of pig iron production that went sort of sharply upwards at a sort of 45-degree angle. Rather, we see different countries, different groups, moving in different directions at different times. And I think it's helpful here to remember, of course, Huntington's distinction, his reference in the three waves of democracy, of course, to reverse waves, not just forward waves, but reverse waves. All of them that had followed the three forward waves, all had been followed by reverse waves. Something of the sort seems to be going on. Certainly in the post-Soviet world, there is a widening spread, in fact. If you compare 1992 with a grouping towards the middle with 2002-3, you can see that there's been a movement upwards and there's been a movement downwards, but not in a single direction. And, of course, more have moved down, actually, than have moved up. Three have moved down and two, so to speak, have moved up. Now, half of the former Soviet republics outside Russia are classified, in this exercise at any rate, as not free. But let me also call your attention, so to speak, to net change, to the difference between the starting point and the current end point, where these regimes were, at the where their regime was in round about 1990 to 91, the last year, full year of existence of the USSR, and where they are now. And you'll notice, I think, that whereas the USSR was classified in its last year of existence as partly free, and Russia now is partly free for Freedom House, nonetheless, it's at a lower point, 5.4, I think, down to 5.5. And it's not just true of Russia. In fact, more of the former Soviet republics are below where the USSR was classified in its last full year of existence than are above it. They have really lost ground. They haven't been making a transition towards democracy. They have been moving, these figures have any validity at least, in the other direction. They've been moving away from democracy rather than towards it. Now, this is the evidence that I wanted to present, so to speak, looking at them from outside, from a place with no doubt fallible judgments in New York. I also want to look at what those who inhabit the these countries think of the changes through which, after all, they have lived? How does it seem to them? How was it for you, so to speak? And I want to do this, I necessarily must do this, through survey responses. I'll be using data collected just over a year ago in association with the Institute of Advanced Studies in Vienna, my colleague Christian Herpfer. An identical questionnaire was used, and reputable agencies were used in all of the seven countries that are involved in this case. I'm happy to supply specifics. This evidence hasn't been reported, I believe, so far in any form, certainly not in Britain. And responses of this kind give us, it seems to me, the views of ordinary people 10 years or more after the changes that are supposed to have transformed their lives, or at any rate to have transformed them into something that can usefully be called democracies, or perhaps of capitalist kind. And note that the countries involved, that the choice of cases is relatively unusual. I think that is helpful, in fact. Four of the countries are from the European former Soviet Union: Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and Moldova. But there's also a country from the Caucasus, Armenia, and two of the countries are from former Soviet Central Asia. We have figures here for Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan. And it seems to me far too often our studies of this notional transition, or the wider processes taking place across the post-communist and post-Soviet world, are based just upon countries of Russia and East Central Europe, or a group of them at any rate, rather than upon the whole range of the former Soviet republics. And that, I think, has given the findings, given many pieces of work, a rather optimistic bias. And of course, the practical reasons involved here, that it's actually difficult to conduct reputable survey work in some of the former Central Asian countries, but it can be done, and the results appear to me plausible. Now, there's a mass of findings that I could pick out, and that's not appropriate, obviously, to do so here and now. For example, we asked for broad judgments about the most desired forms of rule you could choose. Maybe not a wonderful choice: communism, army rule, monarchy, a strong leader, or some sort of undefined democracy. We also asked about the present, the future, and the past. This is a relatively familiar question. The World Value Survey, for example, uses it all the time. And actually, in every case, surprising or otherwise, in every case, the Soviet past was rated in political and also in economic terms ahead of, above the present system, situation in all of these countries, and rated above the situation they expected to be in 10 years' time in all of these countries. But I don't want to go into those. I would rather like to look at some of the more specific judgments about ways in which the nature of the regimes might have changed in these countries over this period of time. In other words, I want to disaggregate and speak not just of change of system, but changes in which respects within these larger categories. I say here, see figure two, if Mick would be kind enough to put up. Now we move to color. This is about the most useful thing I learned in my last research project, was to do these things in color, and you've probably gone to excess now. The choice of color I haven't troubled myself about. So I want to start then, and this is the views of 1,000 to 2,000 or so representative samples in these seven countries. I've averaged them. The differences by country aren't enormously large, and I'll mention them where they're relevant. I'd like to begin by looking at classic individual freedoms. What about the right to do this, the right to do that, and so forth? Generally, this is, so to speak, the good news. We find that freedom of speech is believed markedly to have improved. We find that ordinary people are much more likely now to say that they have freedom of conscience. There is an exception, actually, for whatever reason: Armenia. People appear to think that they don't have freedom of conscience in Armenia, which is hard to understand, but it's not a mistake. I've checked it. Nonetheless, the general view is, of course, and how could it be otherwise, that that there is a very high degree of freedom of conscience in these particular seven post-Soviet republics. Freedom of expression is there as well. This is the wrong one, sorry. I hope you are not spoiled for my next turn in the argument, but nonetheless. At any rate, well, that looks better now, yes. Freedom of conscience we have here, freedom to practice a religion or not. Say that means freedom of expression, your ability to express yourself, speak freely, and so on, say what you think. Freedom to join any organization you might want. As you can see, the blue column is very much higher. Armenian is slightly more cautious. And then the freedom to travel wherever you might want. It's not, of course, for practical reasons, always terribly easy to arrange, money and this sort of thing. But nonetheless, all of these individual liberties, classic rights of individuals and individuals in relation to other individuals, all appear by a very large margin and virtually in every country, not just average, so to speak, across the seven, to have improved markedly. But that, as I suggested, is the good news, what you, I'm afraid, already know. What you know is that there is bad news, so to speak, that a very, very different picture emerges. I think even the most short-sighted of you will notice that the picture is very much sloped in the other direction in every case. A very different picture emerges if we look at the relationship between individuals and the state. Take, for example, the question of the rule of law. We asked whether you felt that you were likely or not to be arrested illegally. And by a margin, you can see almost half say that they do think there's a serious chance of being arrested illegally in spite of the changes that have taken place and the notional establishment of separation of powers and the rule of law and matters of that kind. If we look at a number of other things, if we look, for example, at interest in politics, whether people are free to take an interest in politics or free not to take an interest in politics, which is a perfectly decent human freedom as well, we find that by some margin, people appear to think nowadays in these countries, averaged across the seven, that they don't think they are more free to, that they are free to take an interest in politics or not to take an interest in politics. And if we move to what's, I think, for my purpose, not just the starkest of these findings, but actually the most important, if we look at political efficacy, and by this I mean what's sometimes called internal efficacy or personal efficacy, the belief, in other words, on the part of ordinary citizens that they can, this is a question not about whether they do, but about whether they can influence government. We asked this question about national governments, about the national government, and we also asked it about regional governments, and you will notice that there is a dramatic difference between the two of these. Throughout the region, there is a very low level, between 6% and 10%, of those who think that they can exert at least some influence on government, a lot or some, generally some, 6% to 10%, typically 80% to 90%, huge difference, think that they have little influence on government, or more often, none at all. A little more confidence across the region in regional levels of government, but only a little. The disparities, again, are huge, and the largest numbers in both cases are those who say, no, they have no influence at all on the government that now, of course, is notionally freely elected and subject to democratic mechanisms. Now, of course, comparatives will already be restless because, well, in which country does the government directly reflect what we might wish? In which country, in reality, are citizens equally effective in influencing government policy? Many of us, I imagine, took to the streets on the 15th of February, the largest numbers ever seen in the streets in Britain, I believe, ever, which had no effect on a war that began about a month later. Wasn't much use in my own case even trying to write to my MP because he sees George Galloway. And I don't think he needs much more persuasion. He needs maybe something else at the moment. But these feelings of powerlessness, these feelings that really there's nothing you can do, that government is remote, beyond your reach, beyond your effective influence, are actually, if you hunt up the figures for Western countries, much, much higher across post-Soviet Europe than they are in Britain or the West. And I got, just for argument's sake, a figure which is a United States, US figure routinely asked, where people are asked if they agree or disagree with the view that, generally speaking, people like them don't have much say on what the government does, which is the closest to the question that I could find, whereas 6 to 10% in the post-communist region here, the post-Soviet republics, think they can have some influence of government defined in this way. Fully 50%, I'm not saying they're right, but fully 50% of Americans believe that, yes, they do have some degree of influence on government in their country. So there are huge differences. between countries, as well as huge differences in terms of levels of political efficacy. And there's certainly very little evidence here, it seems to me, of a clear break, either in form of rule or across the post-Soviet region as a whole, or in the sort of departure that people spoke about earlier on from longer-term authoritarian patterns. Now, I want to draw now just a few more general conclusions. This is the last part of what I want to look at. I think a first conclusion, and obviously you're welcome to improve on these or reject them, and this is very much an ongoing process, so to speak, and an interactive process in which many are engaged. I think, for me at any rate, a first conclusion is that it isn't particularly useful to look across at least the seven or so countries or across the former Soviet republics at a transition to democracy. Almost all parts of that proposition, seems to me, are unhelpful. Rather, we're looking at a variety of patterns of change, and we're looking, among other things, at no change, and we're looking, among other things, at change away from what we might think of as democracy rather than a change towards it. And more than anything else, you may form your own views, but at least for me, more than anything else, what we are seeing, as it were, underlying once the imposed forms of rule have been removed, we're looking at political culture, what many of us have for a long time thought of as political culture, which of course itself reflects a number of circumstances. It reflects, for example, how long the countries concerned have had independent statehood, for how long they have had a universal franchise and meaningful elections before or after, but before particularly communist rule, whether they espouse a form of religion which is reasonably clearly differentiated from the state to provide the sort of conscience and the notion of values that are higher than those of the state that have been very important in Western countries, whether the rule of law has at any time played a part, whether, for example, the country ever had Roman law, surprisingly important. Poland did, and I think it matters, obviously, after a very, very, very long time. These, as many of you know, were categorized with the sorts of qualities that Huntington picked out as characteristic of the West. Mythical or not, it seems to me, nonetheless, it's rather striking that there are no countries that Freedom House would regard as free, that is to say the three Baltic countries, that are not also culturally Western in this Huntingtonian sense. And equally, I say, I hope not to be insulting here, equally, there are none that are Muslim that are even partly free, let alone wholly free, with the doubtful exception of Azerbaijan, which, as I said, on the scores should probably have been elsewhere. I think, secondly, it points to the reminds us the importance of what's sometimes called the electoralist fallacy. This is the term that's used in Linz and Stepan's book and elsewhere, the view that once you have competitive elections, that everything follows, that elections are more than a necessary condition of democracy, that they are in perhaps even a sufficient condition. And we surely know better now. We've had in many, many of these countries several rounds of elections, founding and subsequent elections, been held regularly. There's been a choice of candidate. There have been international observers. I and some other people in the room have indeed been international observers on some of these occasions. Elections have, as a general rule, though perhaps not admittedly everywhere, been pronounced free and fair, sometimes as early as the morning after the election has taken place. But it's very clear, if you look at the survey evidence, that ordinary people don't think these are elections that have given them an effective lever of influence over government. Clearly, they're not enough. It's not enough just to identify competitive elections, multi-candidate elections. We need to look at a much wider context. We need to look, for example, at campaign spending, which is a question that's been, of course, troublesome in many Western countries, but has been completely out of control in much of the region that I'm speaking about. We need to look at whether the media are at least tolerably balanced, and I'm afraid that situation has got worse rather than better, at least in Russia over the period that we're looking at, the last 10 or 15 years. We need to look at something called, and specialists in the region will know this phrase well, administrative resource. I see that sometimes translated in the current digest as official clout, the power of office, the ability of people, for example, to work, to hold an official position, but at the same time to be active on behalf of one of the candidates. Notionally, they're taking time off for lunch or something like that, all which is very, very difficult indeed to credit. And it seems to me a whole series of fairly far-reaching changes will need to take place. Changes to some extent of a formal or institutional kind, I think they're not unimportant. Perhaps if the elections were to take place to a parliament to which government was accountable, if, for example, it would make a very big difference in itself, and that doesn't even need constitutional change. But I think more than constitutional changes are needed, probably, if you like, normative or value changes are needed as well. Elections that come to be regarded by those who engage in them, the players as well as the audience, so to speak, as not winner takes all, as something where you have to respect a sort of result that you don't want. The distinction, I think, is very nicely just pointed up in something I just read by Lilia Shevtsova, who said that in the West, I think this identifies the difference, in the West, in these elections, the rules are fixed, but the outcome is uncertain. And in too much of the region, as she puts it, the outcome is known in advance. It's the rules that are unpredictable. And we need, I think, to get away from that. So danger of focusing just on elections, equally, and perhaps I'm slightly out on a limb here, it seems to me just as we shouldn't believe that elections of themselves convey all that we might think of as democracy, so too, perhaps we, or some of us, some people maybe including, we have been a little too dismissive in the past of some of the mechanisms of, let's not call them democracy, but perhaps accountability or influence of the Soviet past. The more, of course, you regard those mechanisms of influence of the Soviet past as having had value or as having been perceived to have value by people in the region, the less they're likely to be impressed by the kinds of changes that are taking place. And it is, I think, sobering to look not at comparisons East-West, which I did a minute ago, but some other evidence that I haven't deployed for you, at whether people in Russia, at any rate, think that the changes that have taken place in the last 10 to 15 years have given them more or less of some of these forms of influence. And believe it or not, and it is in a way counterintuitive, they appear to think that, yes, they have got, compared with before, more freedom of conscience and more freedom of travel and more freedom of movement, but they have less influence in government than they had before. Less influence, even though, of course, now they have generally competitive elections and a range of other changes that we think in our Western way of themselves convey effective influence over government. That's clearly not the Russian view. They think government now is less likely to treat citizens fairly and equally than it did in the Soviet period. And they think they are less free, less protected from arbitrary or illegal arrest than they did in the Soviet period. And these, seems to me, are things that we have to take on board. And how might we explain them? Not something I can attempt now, certainly, but one factor certainly is corruption. The extent to which corruption has rampaged across the region since the establishment of, since the end of communist rule, I think is the phrase I'm using, which in the view of ordinary citizens, perhaps rightly or wrongly, has got quite out of hand. Also, I think, the end, strangely enough, of Communist Party dominance. A lot of people will say to you that, at least in the past, there was a way of going above local bureaucrats, a way of getting someone who would knock heads together, a mechanism that would work for them. Now they don't have that mechanism. Perhaps in due course they'll have something else. They may have an effective political party system, but they don't have it at the moment. And so it seems to me that perhaps there was more reality, at least in some parts of the region, in the mechanisms of accountability that they left behind than in the ones that they are now trying to come to terms with. One final thought, which is that the language of transition seems to be now just rather hard to keep with, rather superseded. It's not just my own view, it's the view of some of the people writing in the Journal of Democracy and other places. After all, we've had quite a long time, 10 to 15 years, it's a long time to go on calling these countries in transition to somewhere or other, be it the West. What a number of people have concluded in the literature, and I think I share this view, is that these countries aren't any longer, many of them, aren't going anywhere. They've got there. They've got where they want to be. They don't intend, at least their leaderships or elites don't intend, that they should go any further towards elections that really would be more genuine and towards media that really would sink their teeth into their ankles if they chose to do so, and to courts that really would represent a bulwark of individual liberties. Rather, it's suggested in some of the most recent literature, at least that I've come across, we shouldn't start from this perhaps ethnocentric assumption that they're bound to be in transition to something rather like us, and what a comforting and perhaps rather misleading thought that is. Rather, they are in the course of establishing something quite distinct, something that may well last a considerable period of time, something which, of course, you readily identify with if you approach the region not through the lens of Europe, or Western Europe particularly, but through the lens, say, of sub-Saharan Africa or many parts of Latin America. Something that we can use various labels for, but semi-authoritarianism is a label that's now, I think, being increasingly used. And these aren't regimes that are in some way stuck, that are just semi-authoritarian, but never mind, in due course, all will be well. They are where they're going to be. And they join, of course, a very large category of regimes worldwide, which provide food for the comparativist. So let me end there, and I hope it goes without saying, and I think indeed, in fact, I've said it if I needed to, that these are thoughts towards a subject that is very actively debated, on which I couldn't certainly pretend to have, on which I couldn't pretend to have spoken the final word, but I hope some words that will help to contribute towards what may eventually be a final word. Thanks very much.
Stephen, thank you very much. We have about 15 minutes left, and of course Stephen is very happy to take comments and questions. Who would like to begin?
How much do you think that the political dissatisfaction, which is revealed by the surveys in seven countries, is it?
Seven
countries, has economic roots, because all these countries are a good deal poorer now than they were in 1989. And clearly one of the things which you hope that your government will do will be to improve your standard of living. If it's manifestly not doing that, would you become disenchanted? I think that all the countries, having gone down a long way, are now beginning to show positive growth. So, perhaps that advantage for some.
Yes, absolutely fair point. It seems to me part of the answer lies in a form of analysis that I haven't tried to engage in here, and indeed haven't engaged in, which would, of a regression kind. Nonetheless, as I think you said, in most of the region, these are not economies any longer that are contracting. The Russian economy, for example, as you know, after the devaluation and so forth, default in 1998, bounced back. 10% growth, I think it was, in 1999. 4, 5, 6% over the last 2 or 3 years continuing. Under the current leadership, you might well argue that this is a rather strong position for the current leadership to be in, and that people should be feeling good after having certainly felt very bad for a very long time, at least in Russia. Across the region, the same is true, although with isolated exceptions. I believe Kyrgyzstan, which is certainly one of my seven, suffered a contraction in the year 2002. So I think in principle there's a great deal in what you say, but I'm not sure that that the economic performance of these countries over the last 2 or 3 years, including well into the period in which these surveys were conducted, in fact should be one in which people should have been feeling bad. We've all sorts of measures, of course, of these other than, as it were, objective measures of how well off they are, which are problematic for all sorts of reasons. We have measures, for example, of how well off people think they are, and how well off they think their family is, and how well off they're going to be, and all the rest of it. And these measures are all up, at least for Russia, which is where the evidence is most familiar to me. But I think in most of these other countries as well, they're beginning to tail off. So I'll certainly hope to work further on your question, but I don't think actually that it disposes of the evidence from a survey conducted in November 2001. When they were well into real growth. You know, and it felt like that as well.
And the next. Please, up the back, yes.
I'm thinking of the comment you made about semi-authoritarianism likely to stay, and I wonder whether you could comment on how you see that developing when some of the current leadership goes. I'm thinking particularly of Azerbaijan and Georgia.
I think in Azerbaijan, a particular solution, perhaps some people here will know better than I do, is being prepared. That is dynastic succession. Gaidar Aliyev has a young man, I believe, who's being already, I think he's general secretary of the ruling party, if I'm not wrong, which is usually one step away from the presidency. He suffered, I think, a heart attack recently, if I'm not wrong, and he is, of course, well into his 70s, though at a recent press conference he stood, I think, for 2 hours or 3 hours when many younger journalists were feeling a bit cramped and so on in the legs. So I think he is preparing for a succession precisely in the semi-authoritarian mode. I have to say the literature, I'm thinking particularly, I should have mentioned it, of a book by Ottaway published this year, who comes out of Carnegie, I believe, and that group of people. The countries that are included in this category do certainly include Azerbaijan, include Kazakhstan, Senegal, Egypt, one or two others. There seems to be a little bit of ambiguity, and I can understand the ambiguity, whether Russia and Ukraine, for example, fit entirely happily within this semi-authoritarian category. But within any category, and the literature makes this clear, at least Ottaway's book, obviously this itself, internally there's a spectrum. And there are the, as it are, the least semi-authoritarian, the least authoritarian members of within the semi-authoritarian category, which possibly accounts for Russia and Ukraine. But in the current work, as people here will know, I'm sure, Russia, Ukraine are seen as, you know, competitive authoritarian countries, straightforwardly by people like Larry Diamond. And you know, I share that view, and I think it's helpful. And I would like, as I was saying, that we should shake off some of the hopeful assumptions, which hopeful not just for us, hopeful of course throughout so much of the region of 1989-91, the annus mirabilis and that sort of thing. In terms of succession, elsewhere within the region, equally a number of quite clever stratagems have been thought up, which it seems to me are entirely consonant with semi-authoritarianism. In Russia, it is speculated that, first of all, Putin, 14th of March next year, it's speculated that he will do a Yeltsin, in other words, that he will resign early. According to recent reports, he's rather tired and fed up and things aren't going his own way and he trusts no one. So thought he would retire early at the end of a second term, retire prematurely, would institute so to speak, authorized successor, quite possibly Mr. Kasyanov, the current prime minister, though there are various views. And there would then be the same abbreviated election campaign that took place, which made it almost impossible for Putin to be defeated in his turn when he was elected in the year 2000. So this sort of quasi-dynastic succession there, I believe that Kuchma is busy grooming his own successor, somebody that would be consistent with his particular clan interests as well. And I think patterns of the sort are going to be very widely reproduced and continue to be reproduced across the region.
I thought that the country level statistics that you gave were really very interesting, but if you were to disaggregate those statistics and look, say, at the responses by class or by gender or by nationality or by region, what kind of light would that throw on your conclusions? For instance, your answer to the last but one question on rate of economic growth, for instance, you might find very great differences in responses in different areas of the Russian Federation, and you might also find very different attitudes by different age groups and by different sex groups, by different class groups. So perhaps you could comment on differences within these societies and how far those differences might reflect and might be different if you looked at different different groups of the population.
Mm-hmm. And that's that's largely a matter for future work, I think I have to say. And I would only point to the magnitude of these differences. On the aspects that were of most interest to me, which, as you probably would gather, were the political efficacy measures, the differences are so enormous that they would swamp any gender, age group, or other kinds of subgroups. And I would have thought, that's really quite sufficient. What I'm most interested in, the results are really rather clear. But I'll hope to pursue these matters in future work.
In the Eastern communist countries, where you've still got a one-party communist government, but an open market economy, one's had a tremendous expansion economically, but at the same time a loss of any social economic cushioning, unemployment benefit, pensions, free health, free education, etc. What has been the position in the ex-Soviet bloc for that economic cushioning?
I need, obviously, to deal adequately with that kind of question to start from a very different point and to cover a whole range of material. A few comments nonetheless. One of them is, for example, if we look at such an important measure as unemployment, the levels of unemployment remain surprisingly low. Something like 7 or 8% is the figure I think most usually quoted for Russia. The reason that it's only 7 or 8% appears to be that many of the enterprises which have technically been bankrupt and are trading at a loss haven't in fact been dissolved, and people continue to work, whether they're being paid adequately or not paid at all or accumulating debts. They simply haven't been put out on the street. How long that can go on and how long debts can mount of unpaid salaries and so on, I would find it difficult to say. But generally speaking, just as in the old Soviet period, there were a number of social guarantees. People would be protected, would be provided with housing, and so on. It seems to me that the current authorities have tried very hard indeed to avoid some of the tensions that would arise if they withdrew all of these social guarantees and housing and transport and things of that sort. The tensions, it seems to me, are currently actually reasonably acute. The waves of strikes that have taken place across Russia in the last 2 or 3 months, the regime will find, I think, very difficult to deal with. In other respects as well, I think this is a rather tense period, and the regime will probably find it rather difficult to sustain those social guarantees much into the future. For a long time, the people have measured protest potential, things of that sort. If the regime is no longer able to sustain those guarantees, and if it's forced to make people actually unemployed rather than turning up at the factory and not being paid, then really very large tensions indeed are likely to occur. So I think I'm rather impressed by the extent to which there are social tensions that the regime really hasn't been able to come to terms with. For many people, it's not only simply their ordinary living standards, a change in their place in life, a whole range of other things which affect people just as much. I think if I was to say any more, I would really need to start in an entirely different place. So perhaps can I just leave it there?
We're being pushed by the clock. There are a couple over here that I think could we take together, and then I think we'll probably have to go to Klaus and Chris. Yeah.
You mentioned a number of factors which might have influenced the patterns that you find. I was struck by the fact that many of these countries have been, for more than 10 years, been subject to a great deal of international attention, assistance towards democratization. That's where a lot of this transition view comes from the World Bank, from the International Monetary Fund, from the UN, a huge range of international organizations involved in trying to further not just economic liberalization, but also democratization in that region, in those countries. Are all these bureaucracies that have been growing up to do this business of democratization really for nothing, which is really what one would, the conclusion one would draw from the picture that you've painted.
Sure, yeah.
Actually, mine is very closely related to that. The picture you painted was one of drift, of no pattern, and indeed you sort of very much associated the idea of transition with teleological notions. But there are two points I'd like to make. I mean, first of all is that the early writing on transition, if you take O'Donnell and Schmitter's work of 1986, they were actually very careful to say that they were not actually automatically predicting a transition to democracy as such. And they talked about transitions from authoritarian rule. And the second point is related to what Klaus Goetz was talking about, namely the fact that this sense of drift, which undoubtedly comes out of your data, is set in a context of a dominant core within the international community, which is determined not to let it drift. There is in fact the dominant core, military and economic core within the world, which has an agenda of seeing that its political system is spread out to the other parts of the world, and continues to measure progress in those countries by the degree to which their systems are gradually becoming more like those of the dominant core. And in fact, that is how political change over the centuries has mainly been achieved, by weaker countries actually adopting the customs of the stronger.
Well, thanks for those two points, which I think are entirely consistent, actually, with my argument, and let me say why. In relation to civil society and so forth, there's now a large literature, a growing literature. I'm particularly impressed by a piece I read by Sarah Henderson, I think it's Comparative Political Studies last year. Perhaps some of you will know it. There's a range of other work of, if you like, a critical kind about civil society, which is talked about sometimes in rather uncritical terms. The view that we get from people who have, in fact, been engaged in the rendering of assistance, democratic development, and so forth, Thomas Carruthers has written about it, a number of other people, is, I think, a rather jaundiced view. Certainly it's true if you read Sarah Henderson on these matters, who's interviewed extensively the sort of people. What sorts of things emerge? It emerged that the agenda is driven very much by Washington, that people within the region develop a network of clients. These clients are the people who, well, generally speak English, among other things, but also, above all, they're those who mouth the same sorts of meaningless phrases about development and trickle down and this sort of thing as the organizations that provide their funding. The funding decisions are typically made in Washington by people who have no connection whatsoever with the field, who haven't even dispatched people to work there. This is, in other words, a little bit like the quality assurance in universities, so to speak, which becomes the quality industry. There's a civil society industry, I'm afraid, in relation to many of these countries. It's far from clear that they've been of practical value or have shifted values or have done anything than shift a certain amount of public money into maybe more deserving hands than would otherwise be the case. It seems to me there is scope for this kind of intervention, but it's scope of a rather narrow and specific kind. It might be advice. I think British Know-How Fund targets a number of quite specific things. It's plumbing, isn't it? Or it's certainly banking or livestock farming, or it's aspects of life, engineering, as of that appear completely free, though maybe they're not, of ideology, but practical assistance. And that, it seems to me, is what Western countries should be doing, and in many cases, they're certainly not doing that. Sarah Henderson, and there is another lady called Sarah, and the name escapes me, who's written with Glenn, equally a book that Columbia published this year, which is a book of a general kind about precisely, in a critical sense, about the democracy assistance industry, what it's done, and those that it has benefited. And I think the picture that comes across is one that would not encourage you, frankly, to vote more funds for this sort of activity, or at least you wouldn't expect it to bring about the changes that you might want to see. As for external intervention, as it were, the wider context, by all means, I agree with that. However, I think it has, that general point has actually quite disturbing implications for the former Soviet republics. And this is along the lines of the argument well made in a journal that Margot Knight will know about, the danger of having new dividing lines in Europe. What appears likely to happen is that, of course, it will be the case that those countries that are candidates to join the European Union are likely to, already they will have to conform and to the Copenhagen criteria and things of that sort, even countries that are likely to join, Romania and so forth, in 2007 are likely already to be working on the acquis and on changing their legislation and forms of rule. Countries even a little bit further afield that think it likely they might at any rate be affected by those changes within the European Union core are making some changes of that kind, among things because they think it's desirable to do so anyway. This is a view put to myself and two colleagues, for example, in Kiev in interviews within the parliament. We believe in these changes for themselves. It's not just because the EU is pressing, but it's surely far more likely that some kind of new dividing line will eventually emerge. We've seen all kinds of bits of evidence of that in and around Kaliningrad and so forth. Construction of barbed wire fences with, for all the world, like gulag camps being reproduced all along a new and very important border. And from this new Europe, the Europe I've been talking about, is going to be excluded. It may combine to a greater extent within and among itself through Euro-Asian economic unions or economic communities or things of that sort. But it's, I think, also likely that hostile and resentful attitudes will develop and that a number of the social problems that could have been alleviated with European Union assistance or indeed advice will not be alleviated or assisted. Crime, AIDS, a range of matters of that sort, narcotics and things of that kind. So from this point of view, the external environment, while absolutely crucial, it seems to me, in perhaps establishing, certainly locking in a number of the changes in the former, in the Baltic Republics, for example, or in Central Europe, will be most unhelpful to the countries which, if we take Mr. Prodi at his word, will for all time be outside that sort of association. And it's, I think, for reasons such as that that a number of us have persuaded HM government through the Economic and Social Research Council to explore exactly what kind of relationship will develop, given the dangers that those excluded will become resentful and that problems will be multiplied within what I think some describe now as the European Union's proximity zone. But as things now stand, I would draw pessimistic rather than optimistic conclusions from, as it were, a wider canvas and from looking at the whole of Europe and East-West interactions for the implications for the former Soviet republics on which I concentrated.
Good, thank you very much. We got the characteristic quite a combination, exemplary scholarship, extraordinary range, and lots to provoke. I hope to have the privilege of publishing the lecture in an issue soon of Government and Opposition. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.